I don't know about you, but it feels like a lot of my friends are now getting on that baby train. If you have a friend who is also expecting or have little ones still in diapers, I always recommend Pampers Swaddlers. With Pampers Swaddlers, you can also rest assured that this diaper will prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers has dual leak guard barriers at the legs to help protect where leaks happen most, and they have a blowout barrier, which is an innovative back pocket built into the diaper to help prevent those messy leaks up the back. Did you know that on average, babies will use up to 8,000 plus diapers before becoming potty trained? That is a lot. That's why Pampers Diaper Stash is the hottest baby gift for 2024. So give a gift to a loved one that says, "We see you and we've got you." Pampers Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund that all parents with little ones will love. You can organize friends and family to contribute to a group gift of an online stockpile that never has to run out. Pampers Diaper Stash is great because it takes the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. It's so easy to do, and it's the gift that always fits.
Welcome to ABG, Asian Boss Girl, a podcast for the modern day Asian American woman. I'm Janet.
I'm Mel.
And I'm Berna.
We get a lot of questions about the topic of personal finance. Helen, Mel, and myself have shared some of our own experiences, practices, and tips in past episodes, but we've been wanting to chat with someone who has a lot of experience in personal finance beyond just their own experience, and who can speak to it from the perspective of a millennial Gen Z woman of color and child of immigrants. Wouldn't you know, that is really hard to find.
In comes Berna Anat, a first-gen child of Filipino immigrants and financial hype woman dedicated to making financial literacy more funny and accessible for young people everywhere. Berna is a host of Betches Money Please podcast. She's spoken at venues like the Girl Boss Rally, Google, and The Wing, and her work has been featured on platforms such as Forbes, The New York Times, and BuzzFeed. Berna was recently named one of ABS-CBN's Global Pinoy Idols, awarded to the 10 most influential Filipinx people in the United States. Please welcome to the Asian Boss Girl podcast, Berna!
Thank Woo! You so much.
Welcome, Berna.
I'm body rolling. You can't see me from my mic, but I'm twerking around my mic for you all. I'm so honored, so happy to be here with you two. This is an incredible podcast, an incredible show. And as always, I'm like, I see two women of color, two people of color, two Asian women. I'm like, oh, safe space. Okay. There's like a certain vertebrae that like unlocks that doesn't when I'm talking to other folks. So it's so wonderful to be here.
Oh my gosh. We're so excited to have you, Berna. As we said, it was really hard to find someone mm-hmm. who would be a good fit to talk about this topic with us and our listeners. Yeah. And to connect with a woman of color over money is really hard to find. Yes. Like you share, the world of money gurus is usually very white and very male. Oh, and we have a ton of questions to ask you today. But before we get into all of those questions, we want to know a little bit more about your personal financial journey. You've shared on the podcast that you host and your various social media platforms that at one time you were $50,000 in debt. Mm-hmm. Not only were you able to get out of debt and pay off that debt, which by the way is really hard to do. Yes. So congratulations on doing that.
Thank you.
But you actually saved enough to quit your 9-to-5 job to create financial literacy content full time as well. So obviously, you got a lot of experience in the personal finance space, and we'd love to hear your financial journey and maybe starting out with just the topic of debt. Like, what were the steps you took to get out of debt?
Yes. Oh my gosh. First, I just, again, thank you so much for bringing me into this space to talk about the money things. Yeah. I want to also pull out something that you just said of the educational space and the financial education space, really so many different spaces for us feeling what I found was hella male, hella pale, hella stale. That really stuck out to me when I first started looking into what I had called the ancient Caucasian art of budgeting. I was like, what does it all mean? Yeah. But rewinding from there, the first step I took to get out of debt was honestly to sort of contend with my financial, now we call it financial trauma, like all the icky, all the ick that comes up emotionally when we think about money. I mean, one of the reasons money is such a difficult topic to talk about is because we're told from the very, 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 very beginning of our lives, especially if you are part of I would say it's definitely in the Asian American community, definitely in the Filipino American community, you are not supposed to talk about money. You're never supposed to talk about your family's financial situations. You're definitely not supposed to talk about the negative parts of it. There was a study from the University of Cambridge that came out, I want to say in like 2019, that our money habits were formulated, like kind of solidified between the ages of 7 and 12, which is like super mind-blowing. And so one of the first steps to get out of debt was to sort of look that in the eye. I didn't really understand the concept of like money as an emotional thing until I started to like, let me see what I can do with this $38,000 of student loan debt and this $12,000 of credit card debt, which, by the way, I got from basically being a broke writer in New York City. All that, I'm sure there's, I know there are lots of people listening to that and nodding their heads right now because we all know that song. But before that, it was like I carried my debt around the same way that I think a lot of millennial folks do, which is like I carried around secretly. I sort of towed it like a cute accessory, like I'm broken a mess. Isn't it funny? And the rest of us are broken messy. Isn't it funny? When really deep down, I was absolutely terrified and confused. Before this, I had no kind of financial background. I don't have like a background or degree in finance. My family, you know, they immigrated from the Philippines. I'm first gen. And so a lot of this was just me, like, you know, that meme of like the cat hitting the keyboard, just doing like this boom, boom, boom. That was me trying to figure out like, how does one get out of debt? Basically, though, to consolidate my steps of how I got out of debt, one was, again, kind of contending with like the financial lessons and stories of my life. How did I get into debt? Why do I feel this way about my debt and my money? And we can get into this too, but it's also this sort of extensive process of questioning, like, what did I learn about money and debt growing up? What are the stories that were told to me and the stories that I tell myself about money to really sort of understand how the hell did I get here? How did I get in debt and how did I get so terrified of it? And then in the tactical way, I always say that the number one way to get out of debt is to earn more money. Honestly, like so many financial educators are like, there are 10 steps to getting out of debt and here budgeting, saving tips and tricks. None of that matters unless you are getting paid more than what you need to survive every month. I think it can be really dangerous to tell folks that like, oh, you're in debt because, you know, you're dumb or you're in debt because you made bad decisions. No, not necessarily. We know that the wage gap is real and getting wider and wider for women and people of color. We know that wages are stagnant and that the cost of living is up, 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 up all the time. And so that second step is really accepting, like, do I even make enough money to survive? Do I make enough money to put extra towards my debt? Because that's what really takes down debt. So getting a different job after a little while and being like, oh my God, I get a paycheck every 2 weeks. This is crazy. Like a freaking IV drip of money. That helped out a lot. And then the third thing was coming up with a debt payoff plan. And I could definitely go more into this if we want to. But basically, debt payoff, honestly, is like mad boring and very calculated. And the whole idea is that you sort of figure out how much extra money you have every month, if you have any, to put towards your debt. And then you figure out, if you're doing that every month, where is the finish line? And then it's just like beating the drum every month, putting all your extra money towards that debt. The real secret sauce is making it fun on the way there, which is like where my, like that's sort of where like my secret taste is. But yes, let me get off my soapbox real quick because I know I just dropped a lot of words, but that's the debt journey in a nutshell.
Thank you so much for sharing that background. I would love to learn a little bit more about, you had said you were working in New York as a writer and that what kind of switched it for you was starting to increase your pay. When you, I guess when you graduated from college, you had debt. And then when you went into work, were you working at like a, was it like a, were you getting paid freelance? Was it like full time? And at what point did you feel like stable with your income coming in? Or how did you manage that whole process to start getting paid more?
So growing up, I actually really wanted to be the editor-in-chief of a teen magazine. I was a writer. I always wanted to be a writer. And of course, like so many of us, and I'm sure has been discussed on this podcast, that dream got squished pretty quickly, or at least my parents definitely tried. They were like, lawyer, doctor, engineer, pick one of the three. And I was like, I want to write to teen girls. And they're like, ew. But I very much pursued that definitely in college. And so I went really hard with the networking. I ended up working at 17 Magazine and Glamour Magazine in New York City right after I graduated, which was amazing. Yeah. But it was also one of those things where it's like, I'm living my dream. And then 2 minutes later, why do I hate this? This is terrible. Oh my gosh. It was wonderful in a lot of ways. And then it really made me realize that, you know, your job, what it sounds and looks like is one thing, but what you do every single day is completely different. And of course, in the writing industry and in the magazine industry, which is like kind of barely an industry anymore, sadly, jobs were very scarce and they did not pay very well. And I honestly, after a couple of years, figured like, okay, if I'm going to get paid peanuts while living in New York City and like pretending to live my best life while also broke and terrified, I want to really pursue what I'm passionate about, which I realized was actually working directly with young people, with teens. And so I jumped from the 17 ship into working for the YMCA in the summertime. I was a teen programs camp director, and my obviously very Asian parents were horrified because they could no longer brag that their daughter worked at a national magazine. They're like, I'm supposed to tell people you're a camp counselor. I'm like, it was very strange. And then getting paid less, honestly. And there was very much, it was 2 years of being like, but I'm living my dream and I'm sweating and I'm broke. I'm literally Lego blocking together my rent every month. Like, I remember at one point I like secretly took out savings bonds that I've had since I was like my christening and cashed those out because I was like not making my rent. But I was like, but I'm living the dream. And if I leave New York City, go back to San Francisco, I'll like technically have failed. So I'm going to keep doing it. Then this, I had a wonderful opportunity. After 2 years of honestly being extremely annoying on the internet while I was a writer and a video producer, I was being very annoying about teen empowerment and just advocating for young people and young creators. I was tapped to be part of Instagram's very first teen team. I became the teen community lead, which basically meant I honestly like translated memes for engineers at Instagram, like for the technical people at Instagram. They'd be like, so why is this Snapchat hot dog such a big deal? And I'll be like, okay, well, pull up a coffee, I'll tell you. That was my job for 2 years. And of course that came with like, I wanted to move home to San Francisco and it came with a pay bump too. And that's when I sort of had this like financial existential crisis of like, wow, how much of my identity, I've been terrified about money, I've been broke and scared about my debt, but I also was like weirdly comfortable inside of that identity because I was like, well, we're all kind of terrified and scared, blah, blah. And now having a bigger paycheck meant like, oh shit, like this is God being like, you have no excuse anymore. You have to get your shiz together. And then I also learned though in my 2 years being at Instagram and surrounded by tech money that having money does not mean that you get your financial shiz together right away. Absolutely not. You have to work on that still. And even like, and I'm sure we can talk about this from the first gen perspective too, suddenly earning money and more money than my parents had ever made also brought upon all these like weird financial thoughts and guilt and strangeness. And so I had to work through all of that good stuff too. But mostly I was like, this is an opportunity to, again, learn the ancient Caucasian art of budgeting, do something with this money because you are in $12,000 of credit card debt and you have no emergency savings and you have student loans. So that's the king that kicked me in the butt, truly.
Wow. I was like nodding like furiously throughout your story because I have a similar background of just jumping between different types of careers that had ranges of very low income to, higher like, you know, tech income. And a lot of that existential struggle with wanting to do things that I was passionate about, but then also feeling like I need to be able to pay my bills. And then, you know, and then with the guilt of, having something for your parents to be able to like share with their friends. But along with what you said there really struck me was just because you're making a lot of money doesn't mean that you are understanding how to manage your personal finances. And as someone who is whose personal income is changing that drastically so quickly or like over a couple of years, what were some of the tips that you might give for someone whose income is swinging everywhere like and just starting to figure out how to budget? Like what's a good way to start going through that?
Oh my gosh. I always say that budgeting is this like gross burp of a word for what truly is like one of my favorite things in the whole world. Like it's so beautiful to me. I wish we could rename these things. It's very unfortunate that we came late and couldn't rename things like budgeting. But basically, when you are just starting out budgeting, especially when you're like, oh, I have a completely different income. What do I do with all this? That I felt a lot of nervousness of just like, I actually could like live off of this money now. And then there was that instinct. And again, this kind of goes back to like my financial trauma and also like inherited financial trauma from my parents and generations back, the idea of scarcity, right? Like I'm earning more than my parents ever had. This is nuts. And what I know to do with money from what I've watched my family do, because money was so scarce growing up, is spend it when you got it. Like if you're getting money, if you come on like a windfall of money, if you like randomly win something at Vegas, you spend it, you go crazy. You like make it rain upon your family. You use it to flex on people. And so I had to hold back that instinct, but I will admit that like it took me a minute to hold back that instinct. There were definitely a few like heady months of like, I make tech money now, you can't tell me shit. And then it was like, oh, right. Yes, I am actually extremely financially anxious and in debt. So maybe I should pay attention to that. When I first started to sort of understand what budgeting was, budgeting really, it just became this way of organizing your money. And when you like Google how to budget, you get like spreadsheets and apps and like very intensive like boxes of numbers. One thing that I found was really important for me when I first started budgeting is to use a medium that makes sense to you, that actually excites you, that you actually want to touch. We're all so damn busy. Like no one has room in their lives for new things, essentially. And so what I see a lot of folks do is like, I'm going to start to budget. Here's my very complicated Excel sheet. And I'm going to put everything that I spend every single day in it. I'm going to suddenly commit to this new plan every day for the rest of my life because like, I'm going to keep up this motivation for the rest of your life. You're not. You're going to fall off and then you're going to feel bad about yourself and beat yourself up. So what actually I first started doing, I was like, I don't like boxes with numbers in it. I've never been like a math and Excel sheet person. I opened up a Google Doc and I just started to write. Like I said, I wanted to be a writer. I've always been a writer and I love to journal. And so every other Friday, I would open up this Google Doc, which I named Felicia's Wallet because at the time, Buy Felicia was really popping off. And people were like, I wish I could see Felicia's passport. She's always going everywhere. I was like, I wish I could see her wallet. Like, how's a bitch afford all these things?
Yeah.
So I named it Felicia's Wallet. And I just opened it up every Friday, every payday, and literally wrote in words, like, how I felt about my money that day and where I think, like, kind of going back and being like, where did my money go the last 2 weeks? Oh, looks like I spent it here, here, here. It's really painful to look at this, but here's how I feel about it. Like, literally journaling out my feelings about money every other Friday. And being like, look at that. Like, paycheck is the same. I guess that's how it works in the adulting world. So I could try again the next 2 weeks. Here's what I think I'm going to try to do. Here's what's coming up in the next 2 weeks. I know I have to put money aside for. Like, I talk to myself in journal form. And I kept that up. I actually still do it. I still journal. Like, this Google Doc is honestly, like, 300 pages long at this point. But it's what got me into talking about my money and talking back to my money. I didn't go straight into the numbers and the apps and the Excel sheets. I found a medium that worked for me. And that's what I would say to folks first starting out. Like, if budgets and Excel sheets don't work for you, then write it out, dance it out, talk it out, like record yourself talking about your money, or sit down with a safe person and like have every other Friday be like the time where you two sit together and like talk about your money anxiety together. Just find something that works for you, because it doesn't have to be what Google tells you.
I love that advice, because I think I mean, even though my first job was like working in Excel and stuff, I found it really challenging to try to go in there and like map out. And I went through that process, like you said, I planned everything. And then when I wouldn't hit it, I'd get really frustrated. So it's like this constant like falling on and then keeping off. But your approach is, that's such a beautiful different way to go about it, is just to figure out, how do you figure out your relationship with things? And if for you that's writing or journaling, I think that's beautiful.
You just said so many great things from like beginning to now. I'm just processing everything, but I just relate to a lot of things you said. Even when you talked about even like moving to New York to pursue writing and need this job, and then because I actually can really relate to that, because I feel like I'm one of those like those Asian kids that, you know, went against my parents and moved to LA to pursue media entertainment. And I started freelancing. I'm just like, oh shit. Like, the thing I like to do doesn't really, I can barely pay rent.
Yes.
And that's when I realized, I think it's good to kind of talk about, you said financial trauma, where it comes from, because that's when I realized, like, why is my mom so against me pursuing this world? Is because I think our families are really big on financial stability. That's so huge, especially as, you know, immigrants coming here to like, you know, start a life. They really want that, to make sure their family is financially secure. And so that's something I feel like you had to talk through and acknowledge within yourself and with your family members, to be like, hey, I understand that, but I'm also like, I'm trying to navigate my own life here. And then again, talking through money is such a sensitive thing, but I love how you shared like the ways you got out of debt. Cause like, I'm not gonna lie, I racked up, you know, a couple, you know, living in LA too. And
yes, this is a safe space. You could
and it's not I feel like sometimes, like even now, like obviously all three of us now are in different places in our lives, but reflecting back, you're like, damn, how did I live off that little amount and make a living? Because I was barely, I don't know about you in New York, but I was sharing a bedroom in LA, and I was like, I couldn't tell people, I couldn't even go on dates to be like, oh, I share a room. Like, you can't even like enjoy your social
come
life
back to my bunk bed. Yeah, 100%. I was in a fifth floor walk up with three other women in New York City. And so it was, and then like in Harlem and like upper Manhattan. So it was like best butt and legs of my life, for sure, going up all those stairs. But it was, it's also like it hits on like what we were sort of saying before we even started recording, is you find yourself in different areas of adulthood and of life. And financially, there are some things, like financially and energetically, that I could put up with when I was in my early 20s of like being broken, scared, and unstable, and also living in a fifth floor walk up with three other women, like crazy fun. Now that I'm 32, I'm like, oh, no, I need my financial stability to catch up with what I want, which is my own bedroom, my own place, you know, like somewhere where I don't have to walk up four flights of stairs. Like it's very interesting to sort of navigate what you can and can't tolerate and how your money has to follow that.
You did say something that like piqued my attention early on. You were like, oh, you know, with budgeting, the word, obviously the word sucks. You're able to get yourself out of debt, and you talk about there's this magic sauce. I'm like, girl, you can't say magic sauce and I'll share it now. The magic thing, or to make it fun, right? And I was like, yes. How do you make it fun?
Yeah, exactly. Suspense. Oh my God, I'm happy to. The make it fun part of finance is like where I'm trying to live forever, because there's the tips and tricks, right? Well, there's that first component that we talked about, which is like, don't even touch the tips and tricks or think about them or listen to them until you know that you're making enough money to cover yourself from month to month. Mm. I really want people to be careful in entering the education space, because some financial educators are quick to make you feel stupid. They are quick to make you feel bad about what your financial situation is. And I have to say off top, like, you are not in debt because you're stupid. You are not behind on your budgeting because you're dumb. There are so many factors that go into it. The biggest being, you might be underpaid compared to your lifestyle. Mm. You know, if you literally don't make enough money to cover you from month to month, that's why you can't get out of debt. That's why you feel financial anxiety. It's this very sad sort of, not even symptom, setting of like this circus of capitalism that we're in, that money is the language of power. We need money to survive. And you can take in all the tips and tricks that you want, but if you don't make enough to survive, that's where you got to start. A lot of folks listening might need to just focus on upping their income before you start managing your money, because when you go the opposite way, when you start to try to manage money that you don't have enough of, that's when we start to feel down on ourselves. Especially, I've found women and women of color start to turn in on ourselves and call ourselves dumb. It's our fault. When really, in reality, one, you're probably underpaid, and two, for so many of us, there have been systemic barriers that have stopped us and especially our ancestors from building wealth. So I can get on the soapbox about that, but there's so many things about it that's like, hold on, wait, before we get to the cute fun stuff, are you making enough money? Do you need to just up your income? That might be the first answer for you. If you feel like you are making enough income to live from month to month and you're like, I just feel like I'm amiss, there's the budgeting, there's the Excel sheets, there's the figuring out your debt payoff plan. But the fun part, is the hype. This is why I call myself a financial hype woman, because the financial education space is so dry and like prescriptive and kind of finger waggy sometimes. And I don't think we focus enough on how delicious and empowering it can feel to finally be in control of your money. So for example, when I was paying off my debt, the very first financial goal I had was paying off that $12,000 of credit card debt, because I learned that credit card debt is like, quote unquote, the most expensive debt. It's like the highest interest rate, so it like costs you the most over time. And I, you know, figured out my debt payment plan. I like got into a free like debt repayment calculator, which you could find on the Googles. And you plug in like how much you can pay every month. It tells you when you might be able to hit your goal, and you can mess around with it. I was like, all right, I got my payoff date like a year into the future. I know what I have to pay every month, and I just have to sort of like hit transfer and hit payment every month. Boring, terrible financial trauma comes on every time it happens. There are a few things though that I did to make it fun. For example, like I learned about debt repayment posters, like you making a poster where it's kind of like that like fundraising thermometer where you like color it in every time you get a certain amount of money. My partner at the time and I, we both were paying off our student loans, and we made debt repayment posters. Mine was like a huge hot pink poster that said, "Buy Felicia," really big. His was a parrot, because he was really into this like parrot documentary of San Francisco. It's very strange. But every time we paid off, we made a payment, we would like have a moment where we'd celebrate and like play music songs, which I now have a very long music playlist on Spotify. We'd like play a music song and make it this whole moment for each other, get like a fat marker and color it in. And it just felt so like celebratory. It felt tactile, like a kindergartner. I knew that I was paying off my debt. Like I'd beep boop bop and do the transfer, submit payment, yay. But I was secretly just looking forward to like grabbing that marker and being like, can't color it in.
Yeah.
Like involving that tactile tracking was so good, but most importantly, it was also involving a person, like having even a small community in my debt repayment plan. When I started to pay off debt and share that with not just my partner, but my friends and family, then other people chimed in. Oh, I'm doing the same thing. Let's get together. And like every time you do it, text me and I'll celebrate you. Every time I, you know, we like kind of co-celebrate in that way. Then it became so much more than, I mean, it kind of got me out of my own cave. We live in like this financial isolation cave all the time where we keep our like money life secret and we even keep our celebrations and successes secret. Mm. And I mean, I know I don't have to tell the two of you because you curate community, but community is like the magic sauce to everything, especially on a topic that's been classically so taboo and we feel so isolated about.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. I can't agree even more. It's like the accountability too that's also really needed too. So thank you for sharing. I also appreciate you sharing the different, like for people from different, I guess, areas of life where they are in their financial journey. But for the people who are pretty confident in managing their personal budget, for these types of people, what are some more advanced, clever tricks or tips you can share with them?
Oh, yes. Okay. Here's another delicious, super fun one. I have a biweekly money date with myself that I've had since like 2016 and I do not break it. So when I was, I could say this now that I'm no longer working at Instagram. When I was at Instagram, I would take an hour every payday, every other Friday, and block out my calendar and book a conference room and pretend that I was having a meeting. I was not. I was having a meeting with myself. I called it my Bay Day, B-A-E, meaning before anything else. It was the same day as my payday. In my head, I was like, before I spend this paycheck, like I just got the paycheck, I'm going to budget it before anything else is my Bay Day. Sometimes I now call it your like personal CFO meeting, chief financial officer of your life. And I sit down in that hour, and that's the hour that I take to open up my bank accounts, take my paycheck, sprinkle it into my different my categories, because I have so many bank accounts. And we can get into the tactile part of budgeting that too. But that's the moment where I take my paycheck, I sprinkle the money into my different bank accounts, I check up on my savings goals, I check up on my debt, I check my credit score. You know, it's like I just sort of like take the pulse of my whole financial life. I defend this time like it's a doctor's appointment. Like I do not let people F with my personal CFO meeting. And I play my money like budgeting playlist the entire time. It honestly, it's probably because I'm a child, but it really takes that moment of like, I'm clicking around into my bank accounts and feeling bad. Then suddenly Boss by the Carters is playing and I'm like, I'm a bad bitch. I am Jay-Z. I am sending invoices to people. Like I am, I'm embodying. It just makes the moment so much more fun. I've also had some budgeting coaching clients who, and I've encouraged them to stack their budgeting time, pair it with something self-care related that you don't usually have time for. And so one of my clients, she would do a full beat face of makeup and like wear her favorite clothes before she did the budgeting. And I've had lots of people be like, that's when I deep condition my hair. Like that's when I binge watch The Office and take my pants off and eat seaweed. Like you pair it with these like very fun, delicious moments. And it sort of rewires your brain to think like, oh, budgeting, when we open up that Excel sheet, I also get seaweed and I get to take my pants off and I get to watch The Office. So I would say absolutely start with like a really delicious biweekly money date with yourself.
I love that. Yeah. And I also want seaweed now.
Word. It should not be limited to your budgeting time. You know, I'm not saying hold back. I think, and another important point to make too is like a budget is not necessarily put your money on a diet, like restrict your money. Right. It's not a thing where it's supposed to, it's not telling you necessarily what you can't have. Budgeting to me is organizing your money so that you know what you can do. Like very, very basic budgeting, like first step is you got to separate your adulting money from your fun money. A lot of us like started off our financial lives with one checking account and one savings account because that's like what our econ teacher made us do in high school for extra credit or whatever. And then living off of that is so difficult, like reaching into this grab bag of money and hoping that there's rent in there and hoping that there's enough for a Friday night out. Separating your fun money in one checking account, your adulting bills money in another checking account, and then a savings account for whatever it needs to be. Just having those three separate is so incredibly important. And I always tell people like a budget is like, it's supposed to tell you what you're saying yes to. You know, if you have enough money in your adulting account to survive for the next 2 weeks or the next month, that means whatever is in your fun account, like that's your fun allowance or that's your shoe allowance or that's your freaking like anime merch allowance, whatever it is that you define as fun, create a separate account for it so that you can say yes to those things while also knowing you can survive because you have your survival money in a totally different bucket.
That's a great tip, is to really just like put them in separate accounts as a way to mentally kind of like keep them separate and also allow yourself to see the positives. And when you said your budget is what you say yes to, I feel like that was like such a good perspective to take on it.
And we gotta have that hype. Another one, you have to stop me when it comes to talking about budgeting because I will keep going, but when you're setting up those bank accounts, another very fun thing that honestly like changed my perspective on budgeting is that you can nickname your bank accounts. I didn't know that you could do this for the longest time, and so people nickname them, you know, like fun, whatever. I'm always nicknaming them crazy ratchet shit. Like it's always a Cardi lyric or a Rihanna lyric or something that makes me laugh, something inappropriate that makes me smile. Especially when it's like a savings goal and like it's like a bikinis and bellinis or something like that, or like bitch better have my money. It's just hilarious to like talk to customer service and they have to be like, so ma'am, we're making a transfer into I'm a ratchet bitch New Orleans account. Like, yes, you are, and we are, and I am. It really creates this, like, personal connection with your money so that it doesn't feel like this, like, number static moving around. You're like, no, I want to embody the nickname of that account. Like, I feel a personal tie to it. So it could be very fun.
I don't know about you, but it feels like a lot of my friends are now getting on that baby train. If you have a friend who is also expecting or have little ones still in diapers, I always recommend Pampers Swaddlers. With Pampers Swaddlers, you can also rest assured that this diaper will prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers has dual leak guard barriers at the legs to help protect where leaks happen most. And they have a blowout barrier, which is an innovative back pocket built into the diaper to help prevent those messy leaks up the back. Did you know that on average, babies will use up to 8,000 plus diapers before becoming potty trained? That is a lot. That's why Pampers Diaper Stash is the hottest baby gift for 2024. So give a gift to a loved one that says, we see you and we've got you. Pampers Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund that all parents with little ones will love. You can organize friends and family to contribute to a group gift of an online stockpile that never has to run out. Pampers Diaper Stash is great because it takes the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. It's so easy to do, and it's the gift that always fits.
Beyond budgeting, you had also mentioned credit cards, and we know that credit cards are a great financial tool, but there are a lot of red flags, as well as maybe green flags. Could you share with our listeners kind of, in your mind, what are some of those big kind of things when it comes to credit cards for someone who maybe is new to the credit card world? Maybe they just graduated. What are your kind of like top red flags and top green flags to look for?
Yes. Okay. If I'm talking directly to a person who just graduated and they're about to get into their credit card life, I could already feel I'm like literally crafting this like fake persona of a person. And from it's the Scorpio in me is coming out and making shit up. this person, I can feel anxiety coming from them already because I think a lot of us, especially like younger millennial Gen Z, saw the credit card debt that the older generations like before us got into. And they automatically think credit is a bad thing. I want to stay away from credit, or it scares me, or it's something that like I could go off the deep end with, so I'm going to avoid it. I would say there is very much a way that you can enter your credit life without automatically like dipping into all that temptation. And also it's worth it going into your credit life because unfortunately, again, weird rules of like the capitalism circus we're in, you will need a credit history and a credit score to do adult shit. Like buy a home or buy a car or get loans, even for things like things that you might need for starting a business. They'll look at your credit history. So you do need to start, and you want to start as soon as possible because one of the many weird ass rules of the credit life world is that the longer you've had credit in your life, the better. So I'm very excited for young people to start with their credit life. But I wish someone told me starting off, it like credit card money is not free money, bitch. I'm not saying bitch to you. I'm saying bitch to my young self. I'm being hard on myself right now. Credit card money is not free money. No one explained to me the concept that the money that you spend on a credit card, you have to pay back. And ideally, you pay back as soon as possible. That is where people kind of get caught up. They're like, $5,000 that I don't have, I am rich, without ever fully embodying an understanding. Like, if you didn't have that $5,000 before, it's going to be very hard for you to pay that $5,000 afterwards. So one green flag I want to offer to this person is absolutely start your credit life, but start it with a secured credit card first. A secured credit card is basically like a debit card or a gift card. You load it with cash you already have, and then you spend it like a credit card. But because it's a secured credit card, whatever you're doing on there counts towards your credit history, which is awesome. And you never go into any kind of danger zone of having to pay back money that you don't have, because you already put that cash deposit down. You're just spending your own money and it's counting towards your credit history, which is awesome. In that way, I would say, like, take a few months to practice paying for things and paying it off right away, like having the money, like little bits of money at a time, and making sure you're only charging things that you have already have the money for. You could also start your credit life off right if you connect with an adult in your life who has good credit, and they can add you as an authorized user to their card. And it's sort of like, it's kind of like copy pasting somebody's report card onto yours. Like, their credit history becomes part of your credit history. And if they have great credit, then you're not starting off from zero. You might be starting off from an awesome place, and that makes your credit history great from the jump. Because I'm trying to get us all to that good credit score life, so we can get all the loans and jumpstart all the intergenerational wealth that we can.
Thank you so much for connecting for our listeners the beauty of a credit card and how that ties to your credit score, and how it's not just free money, and it also affects your life in the longer run in terms of if you want to buy a home and all of these different things. So that is a beautiful goal and a messaging to have for sure.
Yes, of course. I mean, I wish we could avoid it. Like, if you're planning on going off the grid for the rest of your life and like homesteading and just like Animal Crossing for real, then great. You might not need credit, but it's again, one of the weird rules that we got to play by, and the credit system rules are very strange. So you're gonna want to go slow.
I'm like thinking about my future kids. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna get them. Yes. I'm thinking about how I start building their credit. I'll be honest. I feel like I'm someone that even when I look at credit cards now, I get really intimidated still.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, what are some tips for someone like me who's in their 30s and not the most comfortable with, like, I guess my finances or credit cards? Like, I think for someone on our stage of life, like, what are some things to actually like look at for like a credit card noob?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, of course. So I would say, even no matter where you are, a secured credit card is a great place to start, especially if you're nervous about, oh God, don't give me the $5,000, $10,000 limit because I might go off. Secured credit card is an amazing place to start. I would also say that, like, from when you go from secured credit card to the next kind of like more upgraded credit card, by upgraded, I mean, you actually, now it functions like a regular credit card. They give you a credit limit and, you know, they give you $5,000 credit limit, let's say. And then they give you like an interest rate, which is basically like, I think of it as like a percentage of kind of punishment. An interest rate is like, if you owe $100 on a credit card, but your interest rate is 20%, if you don't pay back that $100, they calculate that $100 times it by 20%. And they're like, girl, you owe $120 now. The next month, girl, you owe $100, do the math dollars now. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we start to get nervous, like the interest rate and the credit limit. When you get into that place of like, now I have a credit card with a limit, I want you to always keep in mind, don't go anywhere near 100% of your credit limit. Like, if your credit limit is $5,000, I lie to myself in my brain and I calculate 30% of that, whatever the math is. I'm unequipped to do the math right now, but I take 30% of that and I'm like, that's my limit. I don't even think about the fact that it's even bigger. That's because one of the, I want to say like the number two most important factor to your credit score is credit usage, which means like, if out of 100% of your credit limit, how much of it do you use? And they don't tell you, but they want you to stay under 30%. Again, as a lifelong overachiever, a freaking recovering overachiever, I like to try to stay to 10, 15% of it. And that's very difficult. It requires a lot of self-discipline. But it's important to understand from the get-go, like when they tell you the credit limit, run, just not lies, shut up. Nope. Do the math for yourself and give yourself a credit limit, because going above that, one, it's difficult to keep up with, and two, that tanks your credit score pretty quickly. So just like set yourself up from the beginning of keeping it to between 15 to 30% of your credit usage. And of course, the general rule being like, if you can't put it on a credit, like if you can't pay it off in cash, think twice about putting it on a credit card. We always think of ourselves like, I'm going to put this on my credit card and future me somehow is going to have more will, more discipline, more money. She'll be fine. Like, she'll take care of it. She'll worry about it later. And it almost never works out that way. So take care. Like, look out for your future self in understanding that, like, credit is just for building up this score. It's not necessarily for buying things that you can't afford, because that's where it gets scary. Unless it's a total absolute emergency, credit can be a wonderful thing, but we want to really sort of like temper our mindset before going into credit.
Man, this is great advice. I'm just like mentally noting all this. Thank you so much for sharing that. I didn't know about the 15 to 20% thing. I want to switch it over to saving money, and I wanted to hear more about the fact that, well, first of all, congrats. You saved up enough to quit your 9-to-5 job. Yes. To create financial literacy content full time. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. As Jan and I know, like, going into full time with your own business, your own passion, it can be really challenging and difficult. So it's a huge accomplishment that you're able to do that. What advice would you have for someone who is also trying to save a reserve of money with the hopes of making a career shift and maybe going to their project full time?
Oh my God, delicious. Okay, so I feel like I did a lot of this like ass backwards, and now I get to like be on podcasts and make it sound like I freaking planned all that. I don't know what the hell I was doing. But I've also found that through podcasting communities like this, a lot of us, when it gets down to it, we all admit like, I don't know what the hell I was doing. I don't even know. So everything I say, take it with a grain of salt. It's not like I had this knowledge the entire time. I learned it looking back. So please don't think I'm smart. I just have history of mistakes. Thank God. But what I did was, you know, I was working for Instagram at the time, and this actually, it kind of goes under the general like umbrella banner of like advice I would give, which is like, milk the resources you have now to prepare for the future. I always get very nervous when folks are like, I'm trying to save up a whole bunch of money so I could just quit and finally start my thing. I kind of quote unquote started my thing while I was at Instagram, because I was like, look at this tech money. I got debt. I'm going to milk this hoe for as long as possible. I'm going to do my dance. And I left my job, but I knew, I was like, I'm going to do my dance, get rid of my debt, because there's no guarantee that when I start a business, I'm going to be earning this much and I'm going to be able to keep up with these bills. Let me milk the resources I have now, this tech money, these Zuck bucks, as we call them. Sorry, Zaddy Zuck. Milk these Zuck bucks and get rid of my debt, and also like use this money to save up to quit. Mm. I initially did not save up money to start a business. My partner and I at the time were saving up money to travel for a year. That's what we wanted to do. And of course, in like true millennial 20s-ness, we're like, we're going to travel for a year and then, well, I don't know, see what happens after that. So we were both doing kind of holding our financial goals together, which was great. My first goal, like I said, was paying off my credit card debt with that tech money. Did it. And then it was building my first emergency savings with that tech money. Like my first solid 3 to 6 months, I think I ended up saving like 4 months of expenses of emergency savings. Great. Did it. Then it was focusing on my student loan debt. That obviously took the longest time, took like a year and a half. And we really sort of accelerated and did lots of stuff to try to like make those payments as fat as possible. Did it. And so and then after that, we're like, let's take that same energy, pretend we're still paying off our student loans, but chuck it in a savings account for our year abroad. We did all kinds of like Googling and calculations to figure out like to land on a number. We wanted to together save $36,000 to travel abroad. And so that was like the number we were gunning for. We saved it. We put in our 2 weeks. It was 2 months for me because I'm an intense people pleaser. I didn't want anyone to hate me for leaving. So I put in my 2 months. And then we like lived our year abroad and it was amazing. And then we got back and my partner at the time, he worked for the YMCA. He was like, I'm going to go back to the YMCA. Tight. And I was like, what am I going to do? Like, I didn't burn any bridges with former jobs, so I could have like explored going back to Instagram and the tech money and all that good stuff. But over the last 2 years, as you know, I've talked a little bit about, I started to build this community of financial education and talking more about it. Then I started to see things like brand partnerships come up and speaking gigs. The money started to drip in. Honestly, that started before I even left Instagram. And I was really grateful that I was able to use that time at my full-time job to like basically clear out my financial closet and make way. And I started to earn little drips of money being a financial educator while I was at Instagram. And so I would say, like, to me, it's too much freaking financial anxiety to think of, like, saving up a whole chunk of money so that I can quit my whole job and then suddenly, like, change my lifestyle like that. I actually know of a couple financial educators right now. I can't say their names because they haven't gone public with it yet, but they have been working their full-time jobs while being a financial educator and slowly earning money and building it up as a side hustle. And basically, the formula is that, like, once your side hustle starts to get anywhere even close to your current salary, that's when you start to think of tapering it off. One of my good friends, actually, who is this financial educator who's about to quit, is kind of tapering down to his full-time job becoming part-time and then amping up the volume on his side hustle. So that's, I would recommend more something like that. Mm. There's no rush to get into the entrepreneurship space. There's always going to be room for us, especially if you're a woman of color. There is like hella seats. But financially take care of yourself, because it doesn't have to be, that long story was to say, it doesn't have to be a leap. It could be a very calculated, like leveraging your resources, doing it carefully, obviously, and protecting your job, but leveraging your resources so that you feel secure every step of the way. It doesn't have to be a bungee jump.
Yeah, thank you for that message. I feel like we get asked this question a lot, and we did a very similar approach, which was this started as kind of a passion project.
Yes.
And when it started to, you know, have some financial viability, we were continuing our full-time jobs.
Yes.
And it was only when it got to a place where we're like, we cannot like physically put our full attention to this to, you know, to give it everything it needs and it is financially viable. Mm-hmm. Only then did we kind of make that leap. And each of us kind of had our own ways of managing our personal finances. But I like that message to send to the audience for anyone who is interested in saving money and making a shift to not do it so drastically. Because I definitely did that after my first job. Tripped over my, I was the, Can I'm do. Just going to save and then I'm going to go in. And then it's like, I didn't really have a, you know, a sufficient plan. So I love that messaging of being able to do both. And then the formula you gave was very intentional, which is see how much you can make on your side hustle when it starts to reach the top level.
Yes.
So that was very, very good advice for our listeners.
Yes.
But the other thing I want to tap into, Berna, is you had mentioned that you kind of built the habit of saving or in terms of paying off your debt first, right? Mm-hmm. And then once you started paying that off, your lifestyle is now accustomed to saving, and then you started putting that extra money then into a vacation fund.
Yes.
And like we talked about with the Asian American community, when it comes to saving money and prioritizing frugality, it's a pretty common mindset. I think a lot of us grew up kind of with this idea of always focusing on saving.
Yes.
But if you're going into now as adults and we're trying to make, you know, navigate managing our own budgets, what tips do you have for someone who is trying to find that right balance between saving for your future and being future minded and really like pinching the pennies, but also being able to like live your life?
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of our audience struggles with that because there is this, you know, kind of the Gen Z mentality of wanting to travel and do things that you want. But then there's also that, you know, you have your mom and your dad's voice in the back of your head being like, well, you got to save for your future.
Yes.
So what are some ways we can kind of balance those two?
Yes, absolutely. I would say actually my first thought is that I am working on two types of goals at any given time. There's a long-term goal and a shorter-term goal, because I know that emotionally I need those financial wins. I need to be able to like enjoy my money. If we only ever focus on like, I am going to max out my 401k or my Roth IRA or whatever the retirement account is so that I am set when I'm 65. Like if the ride to 65 is terrible, was it worth it? You know what I mean? And this could be me as a more like kind of youngest child hedonistic thing of just like, I'm trying to have a good time if I'm not here for a long time. But I have to define and hold both goals and both truths at the same time. I want to be set for my retirement. I know what that looks like and what I need to save every year to do that. But at the same time, like mama needs a hit of dopamine. I need to be able to save for Santorini next year. I need to be able to save for Vegas next month. Like I know that I not only like is it financially viable for me to do that, but I need that emotionally, because if I don't, then my relationship with money is always just going to be one day, one day, one day. And so having those two goals for yourself and then defining those two goals for yourself to the T. Like when I talk about savings goals, whether it's saving for Vegas next month or saving for retirement in 30 years, I always say to define it like a movie plot. Like it's like who, what, where, when, why. And the fastest way and the easiest way to do that is I discovered free savings calculators online, like hit the Googles and do free savings calculators. I really like the ones from NerdWallet or The Balance. And basically, it's just a way for you to plug in what goal you have and when you want to achieve it. And it tells you, like, it basically gives you a monthly bill, like a savings, quote unquote, bill of what you need to deposit in order to, like, get that goal. I want people's savings goals no longer to be like, I don't want it to be like, I want to travel. No, I want to hear like, in 2023, I am going to leave my job. In 2023, I'm buying a ticket to Vietnam on this date. It's going to cost this much. And before then, every month, I need to save this much to hit this number so I can do this. Like, get really, really freaking specific. When we start to talk about savings goals in the abstract, it's sort of like, I mean, I'm sorry, I keep going on with these like weird imagery and metaphors, but like, you know, the clothes chair in your room or in your house.
Oh, yeah.
Am I calling you out? Where it's the one chair you just throw clothes on it and you're like, whatever. Yep. I was looking for, like, where's mine? When you turn the lights off in the room, I don't know if you all ever like wake up in the middle of the night and like look over your clothes chair and you're like, it's a demon. That is a monster. That is a serial killer. It's going to kill me. As I stare at it, it's growing. Oh, my God. But then you turn on the light and it's just clothes. That's what I feel like. Your savings goal, like, you need to define your savings goal, because to think about it in the abstract makes it feel so daunting and so strange and so foreign. And so define, like, hold both of those goals for yourself. Understand what it is that you need to feel good about your money on the journey to the longer term goal, whether it's trips or things or experiences or food or meeting people. Define that for yourself and then define the shit out of it. Again, it needs to have a, like, your savings goal should have a who, what, where, when, why. Use a savings calculator and like map all that stuff out so you know exactly where you're going and it's not like a vague kind of stumbling in the dark.
Wow, I love, love, love that advice, because I feel like sometimes as you're like, you're describing, like, you have to understand the who, what, when, why. And like, I think everyone has different types of long-term and short-term goals. Like, I'll be very transparent. My long-term goal actually is to have a really nice wedding. And I think that's, everyone has their own like, perception with how they want to have their wedding. But I think for me, I was able to identify, like, why I want this. Like, what does it mean for me? Mm-hmm. What does it mean for my family? How much do I anticipate my wedding to cost? Mm-hmm. And then I deposit my money towards that. And it's like for me, I'm also like, oh, roughly when do I think that's going to happen? But I think it's good to have something to kind of look forward to. Mm-hmm. And then I love how you just describe, like, the short-term goals, because I'm the same as you. Like, I need to have a short-term, like, whether it's a trip to aim for, because I'm just, then at that point, I'm just working for this thing I'm not going to see in like 10 years or like 5 years. So just not, there's no joy in that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But I think once you're able to identify what's valuable to you and that why, and like, you know, journal it out, I think it's really important. So thank you so much for sharing that part.
Of course.
I know. And totally on the clothing chair. Like, I'll be honest, I'm sitting on my chair right now and all my clothes are on my bed, which I'm going to put back on my chair.
It's strategically out of the camera too, of just exactly. Like, what clothes? What do you mean? I'm clean all the time. I know. I feel that.
No, I totally feel you. I actually want to ask you more about investing. So
yes,
I'll be honest. First of all, I'm very happy for this episode. I think I'm such a financial noob that investing is something I actually learned about more later in my life, and I didn't know much about it. I still don't know. So I feel like maybe a lot of listeners may feel the same way as I do. And because I think we think about investing once we start our corporate job, once we start getting that, you know, that money in the bank, we're like, ooh, we're getting money. What do we do with this? And also, when I think about investing, I think about our retirement accounts. I was never taught this at all. I wish you had it. I wish you had a course on this in college. Like, here, what's a 401k? Yeah. Like, I heard about 401k through Phoebe on Friends, and she didn't know what it was either. Her 401k, she called it.
Relatable, right?
Yeah.
It stuck with you, though. Probably more than maybe somebody. People are always telling me, like, oh, you know, they do teach you about 401ks and whatever in economics or in high school. I'm like, first of all, probably not in my public school. And even if they did, it probably sucked. That's why it didn't stick. Dude. But Phoebe saying 401k, that stuck, because it was relatable.
Exactly. But the thing is, when she said it, I didn't know what it meant. But do you mind sharing with the listeners, like, a little retirement account 101? Like, what's the different accounts and what do they mean? Like, I know there's like a Roth IRA, there's an IRA, there's stuff I probably have no idea.
401k, Roth 401k.
My God. I must say that, like, the investment world, if you're confused by it, then you're right. Because it is a whole different language. I'm literally a financial educator, and investing gives me the pit sweats because it's so like there is, thinking about investing and then cryptocurrency and NFT, like that whole world is almost built for you to not understand it. And now that I've spent some time in the financial education world, I can say like this stuff is built to gatekeep certain people from understanding it and keep certain people out. Like it's confusing because it's working that way. It's built that way so that we are confused. It's when you get to the other side meaning, okay, finally someone like explained investing in a way that I understand, and you start to sort of get confidence. You start to see all the definitions of things can be said so much more simply. Why did we have to name it a 401k? Who is Roth? Like this could all be so much more simple. But it's not, and it's literally built so that only certain people can understand it. So please, I want folks to know, like, if you're confused about it, you're approaching it the right way. It's built that way. And it's very daunting, like you said, to even try to start to understand it. One thing that I like to say to folks when we start thinking about investing is, especially I'm sure you can see on like Twitter and TikTok, people get very hyped up about like certain kinds of investing that are like sexier, like the crypto and the GameStop and the AMC stuff like that. I'm always like, okay, the most important thing when you're starting investing, it is, it's not as sexy, but the first thing I want you to care about is retirement. And immediately, especially like, I feel like Gen Z and millennial are like, boring, don't want to think about my 65-year-old self. One thing that one of my absolute favorite financial educators, her name is Tiffany Alice, aka the Budgetnista, she taught me to think about retirement in terms of taking care of my future self. And in order to care about your future self, name her, name him, name them. Tiffany's future self is named Esther, I think. My future self, so I'm Berna now, but my real name is Bernadette. And I always keep saying, like, I'm not going to go by Bernadette until I'm, like, older and refined. Bernadette is refined. Bernadette is resting. She's a Lola, like, she's an elder. You know, she wears dresses and, like, no underwear. She doesn't give a fuck. Like, she, like, define who this person is, like, who your future retirement person is. What do you want for her? I want her to only be working on stuff that she cares about. I want her to be like knitting thongs and like that's what she, how she makes a living. And like she does it sometimes because she don't care because she's living off her investments. She's in the sun, you know, like really sketch out who this person is you're taking care of because we can't see that. Like our brains are not wired to care about ourselves at 65. But if you think about it as a different person that you're actually taking care of, it really helps. And then the second thing is when you're navigating all of these different freaking accounts, oh my God, like all the language is so annoying. But it kind of goes in like a tier. I try to go like step by step according to where you work. So for example, if you're thinking about retirement and you have a full-time job, the first like stupid acronym, like phrase you need to care about is the 401k. That is a type of retirement account. But the first thing is like, if you have a 401k connected to an employer and you don't know what the hell is in there, go find out what the hell is in there. I worked my very first job at 17. It wasn't until I left like 2 years later that I found out I had a 401k at 17 and that my employer was already putting in money in there for me and I had no clue. Obviously, like, they're like, oh, HR explained that to you on your first day. Bitch, no one's listening to that, especially when you're, like, 24. Like, I'm not listening to that. So find out what your, if you have a current retirement plan, if it is a 401k, find out what it is and trust the fact that there are people in HR who are literally paid to sit down with you and explain that to you. They are obligated to explain that stuff to you until you understand it. I give that same advice, actually, to young folks who are in college and are like about to leave with student loans. I'm like, don't leave without making an appointment with your financial aid officers because they are paid to explain this stuff to you and you don't have to pay them. When you leave that world, you got to pay people to explain this shit to you and it's terrible. So sit down and find out what's in your 401k. Questions to ask, what the hell is this 401k? Like you explain that to me, HR person. It's, by the way, 401k is named 401k for the, it's like the name of the section in the U.S. tax code, which is 75,000 pages long. I'm not even exaggerating. That's the literal. Wow. It's literally, it's, I think it's like three times longer than the Harry Potter series or something like that. But it's named 401k for like the section of the tax code that describes like how taxes move in a 401k. It's so dumb. Yeah. So sexy. Oh my God. Really makes me want to get into it. But if you have a 401k at work, ask, like, is there money being put into it? What does that look like? When? What's the amount? Start to talk to your HR folks and find out, like, Is my 401k attached to any sort of like retirement goal? Find out how it's even being invested. And even if you don't know what the fuck they're talking about when they say it, find out what those words are and let that be like the sort of research point for you. So many people, you just have like a 401k percolating somewhere in the background. And I say that that's super important because it might be that your employer has a matching program, which basically means if you're putting money as the employee, you're putting money into your 401k, your employer's like, tight, bet. In order to like keep you and keep you like, you know, incentivize you to stay, the employer is going to put their own money into your account as well. Coming from, and you all know, coming from the entrepreneurship world, we don't get that delicious shit. No one is putting money into our investment accounts as a favor. And so that's like the ultimate thing I want people to find out. Like, do you have a 401k? How is it being invested? And are you leaving free money on the table by like ignoring the matching program? Some of these things are just like as simple as like, oh, your employer is just waiting on you to go like, yes, please, I want free money. But you got to like know and say and like put in the request. It's so dumb. I'll stop here because I will keep saying words that make me angry and probably make you angry. But I hope that answered some of the question.
Yeah. I had a quick question to follow up because I'll be honest. I was taught when I started my corporate job that a close family member said, don't do your 401k, Mel, because you can't even, your salary isn't enough for you to even live off. So don't put money into your 401k or something like that. And I was like, okay, 401k is something I just won't look at. So I don't know. I don't know if that's like a thing we got to consider because I'm like, oh, do I have to be looking how much I need per month in order for me to even consider putting in my 401k? Or is that an automatic thing? Or I don't know that's something I was taught. I think might be incorrect though.
I would say personally, now I want to caveat and say like, please no one take this as official financial investment advice. You cannot sue me. You cannot sue the podcast. These are stories that we're telling and hopefully you get education from it. I would say that that's not great advice because of course, like I want you to survive from month to month, but I don't want your future self to suffer because of it. Mm. One of the most important things about investing is like, it's so important to invest and start early because the biggest asset you have as a young person is time. You can't buy back time. You can't catch up later in life. Investing works such that it's like growing a fruit tree. The longer you have to grow it, the like sicker and juicier the fruit will be at the end. And so I want young folks who get their first 401k, I want them to invest in their 401k. I want them to protect their future selves and find out exactly how much of your paycheck is being invested in a 401k. It might be that I found out they're actually taking out $300 out of my paycheck every month and I could really use that $300 to like live. Great. Then you can scale back your contribution, but don't stop it. I would say do not stop it because even like putting just $10, $20, $50 in your 401k when you're 22 makes so much more of a difference than when you start at like 35 because freaking investing is weird and then it compounds on itself. You want as much time as possible. And then from that side, it's like if you protect your future self and you put money into your 401k no matter what, even if it's a little bit, and you still don't have enough money to survive, girl, get paid more. That's what it is. Like, don't, like, make your employer answer to that. Don't let your future self suffer because you're trying to survive. You're probably underpaid as a mother effer anyway, and we can do 7 more podcasts on negotiating your salary because that's what you need. They're hiding that money from you. It's bullshit.
Wow, thank you so much for clarifying that tip that I got. I'm like, now I'm looking at myself, I'm like, damn, 10 years ago, I would have been a different place. But it's okay. Yes,
exactly. We learn now. We make up for it now. All we can do is know better than yesterday. That's what we're doing.
Speaking of investments, I feel like the first time I actually heard about investing or like, you know, got into or dabble into it, it was actually my old coworker was like, Mel, I have a financial advisor that I think you should talk to. So after some consideration, I realized it wasn't the best time for me. But in your opinion, when does it make sense to work with a financial planner or a consultant?
Great question. Basically, once you start to feel like this is too much for me to understand. I think a lot of people, especially young folks, kind of understand financial advisors like, oh, that's something I'm gonna mess with when I am trying to buy a house or I'm trying to build a family or like me and my partner are gonna get a financial advisor. A financial advisor can help you pretty much at any stage of your life. It's just it's sort of been sold to us as this like fancy thing you get when you graduate into a certain level of adulthood, and that's not true. I know a lot of amazing like younger financial advisors who just want to, they are open to help at any level of your life, and it's not like a therapist or something where it's like, oh, I got to invest in this person. We're going to stay together for life. That's something I do. I have to make room for every month now. No, this is someone that they can help you on like a few weeks basis, like a smaller one-off basis. It's just a matter of getting the information out there on how to find them. Basically, again, to answer your question, if you start to hit that wall of like, okay, I want to make these next financial moves, whether it's I'm going to start to invest for my retirement, or I'm going to start to think about planning for a wedding, or I'm going to start to think about planning for college or something like that, I'm now hitting my wall of education and I might start to just sort of float away and try to forget. And basically, when you start to hit that edge of like, I might fall off of this if I don't get help, that's when you should talk to a financial advisor. And that doesn't mean, again, it doesn't mean you're signing onto a contract for life. Just talk to one. One resource that I love to share is a website called advisorsgiveback.org. This is it's a resource that began in the very beginning of the pandemic, where a bunch of financial advisors from all over the world decided to donate their time to folks who've never used a financial advisor before. And that's including young folks. You can go onto advisorsgiveback.org, find a financial advisor that is in your area or like fits your life goals or lifestyle, and you can actually kind of do a trial with them either for free or just by donation only. And then after that, every advisor has their own sort of plan where you can continue with them on if you want to, keep paying them, just pay what you can. But it's a really good way to sort of dip your toe into getting help, because I think the biggest mistake we make is like hitting some sort of peak, like saturation point in our financial education and going, oh, it's because I'm dumb. Like I just need to get smarter. Or like, oh, I need to work harder. I need to push harder with my financial education. No, girl, you need help. You need community. You need people who are literally like, it is their job and it is their joy to give you advice that's out there. So try it. Just try it whenever you feel like you're hitting your saturation point, I'd say.
I think that is a great tip. And to your point, I think we have a tendency to look at ourselves and think that it just means that we're incompetent or we should know this better. But when all of the other resources generally are guys or white and it doesn't feel relatable, it's really challenging. Yes. So thank you for that resource. I'm going to check that out, advisorsgiveback.org.
Yes, it's such a good one. And also, like, I want to make sure that I say before we wrap up on investing, like my favorite way, especially to teach young people about investing, is to talk about, and I've got to say it because she is also an Asian boss girl, born and raised in the Bay Area, Ali Wong. Come on now. Ali Wong. She actually is the basis of my investing strategy and like my investing why. In her first stand-up show, I think it's Baby Cobra, she talks about like initially marrying her husband because he went to Harvard Business School, and she was like, that's my investment in my future. Yeah. And she's talking about like Sheryl Sandberg's like book Lean In, and how like Sheryl Sandberg's like, we need to rise at the top. Ali Wong is like, fuck all that. I don't want to lean in. I want to lie down. And so it's like when we're talking about all these like investing terms and like strategies and stuff like that, what really motivates me and fuels me to actually invest and care about investing is the fact that like one day I want to lie down. That's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I'm not investing to be hella rich. I mean, that'd be nice, but not necessarily. I'm not investing so that I can like buy an island. I'm investing so that I can lie down. And I think it's super important actually to identify that, especially for Asian American folks, because we come from a history of a lot of us, like our ancestors never got to lie down. Our ancestors never got to understand investing. And investing doesn't have to be this like tech bro, like freaking testosterone adrenaline thing. For me, I invest because I have the luxury of considering a future wherein I get to lie down the way my ancestors did not. And so if all these things are like investment terms are overwhelming you, just know that like one why that you can hang on to is the ability, like the luxury, the privilege to one day relax. It's, you know, we don't have to supercharge and just sort of bro up our investing thoughts. It could be all for revolutionary rest. That is why I invest.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, that was beautifully articulated. Thank you.
Getting back on routine after the holidays is so tough for me. Finding time to grocery shop and meal prep for the work week is just not happening for January. Thank goodness for Green Chef. Green Chef saves you time by taking care of meal planning, grocery shopping, and most of the meal prep for you, so you don't have to. They make eating well easy with plans to fit every lifestyle. Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, or just looking to eat more balanced meals, Green Chef has options for you.
Personally, I chose their balanced living menu because I definitely was not eating that way during the holidays. I can't wait to try their cauliflower piccata pasta and mojito shrimp, which are some of the recipes included in this plan. I'll do my best to share these meals with my housemates, but no promises there. Green Chef's always changing variety of recipes means there's something new to discover each week, so you never get bored. Green Chef is now owned by HelloFresh, and with a wider array of meal plans to choose from, there's something for everyone. I love switching between the brands, and now my listeners can enjoy both brands at a discount with me. Go to greenchef.com/abg130 and use code ABG130 to get $130 off plus free shipping. Again, that's greenchef.com/abg130 and use code ABG130 to get $130 off plus free shipping. Try the number one meal kit for eating well.
So when it comes to investing beyond just the retirement account, though, yes. say I'm someone and I'm starting to already put in the money, working at my corporate job, they're matching, and I got that. And now I want to look into some other ways to invest my money.
Yes.
There are all these apps around now, like Acorn, Betterment. It can feel a little bit overwhelming to be in that space. Are there apps that you'd recommend for someone who maybe is just starting out investment in that way, where maybe they're already saving up for their retirement? What kind of is the next thing that they want to consider?
Oh, yes. There are a lot of amazing apps that allow you to both kind of dabble in other retirement vehicles and like the cute, sexy stuff. Like it makes me very happy to imagine this person that's like, I'm good at my 401k, or, you know, like they have the retirement plan. What else do they want to play with? At least for folks like myself who are self-employed, I'm like, and this also applies actually to people who also have a 401k and are working, you can also look into opening up a Roth IRA. That is a separate kind of retirement account that is available for anybody with an income. There are definitely like income caps and ceilings, so you'll have to look into what that is and how it compares to your financial situation. But you don't have to do the whole like, I must go to a Vanguard and officially open up a Roth IRA and speak in a British accent. Like, the amazing thing is that there are apps like, I want to say like Acorn, where you can actually open up like quote unquote legitimate investment accounts and not have to do like, a lot of these big investment firms are like, you must open up, like you can open up the Roth IRA, but you have to have $1,000 deposit or something like that. There are apps like Acorn where you can open up a Roth IRA in the app and just start throwing like $10 in it, $20 in it every month, and make it very small and make it very casual, but it still counts as a legitimate retirement account. Also on apps like Acorn, but I really like Public, the Public app, you can start to invest in a more sort of intentional, sort of trendy way where you might be able to get either whole slices or just like part of a slice of a stock of a company that you care about or a cause or a fund that you care about. Public itself makes it very like, and I'm going to start to sound like an infomercial, but I think it's really fucking cool. Public is an investing app where you can sort of see what everybody's doing, kind of like Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. You can see what your friends are investing in. You can see what celebrities are investing in and why. You can track of like the companies that are doing well, and you can put in slices of money. Like, you don't have to go in and with hundreds of dollars and like feel like you're gambling away your nest egg. You could go in with like your lunch money each month and just be like, let's see what happens if I put $10 on Lululemon or whatever. Let me see what happens when if I believe the Tesla hype and like put $50 on it or something. I always say though, with that kind of money, you always want to invest with money you're willing to lose, because as the investment bros like to say, the markets are volatile, which is investment bro speak for shit's crazy and unpredictable. We cannot predict how companies are going to do, how the general overall like economy is going to do. So go into it understanding like you might lose this money in 10 minutes. You might. How do you feel about that? A lot of investment professionals will say to figure out what your risk tolerance is, which basically like how brave are you, or how much of a little bitch are you about losing or gaining money. Like, I'm very risk averse, which means like I get scared about money. If I have money, I'm just like, I need to be trusting that it's going to go away. And yeah, I'm not down to put hella money on random stuff. So I love an Acorn, a Public, a Stash, what other? Like, yeah, there's Wealthfront, there's Betterment. These bigger banks are starting to allow you to get like slices of stock. So you can just play and watch and just see what happens and share what you're learning, which is so new and cool, like on an app like Public. Share what you're learning and see how people who look and sound like you invest and kind of feel safer in that space.
Mm. I love that. That is creating greater access to a community of people that, to your point, that you feel more comfortable sharing this information around and that you can trust because you understand that they probably are coming from a perspective and a context like you are.
Yes, so. Exactly. Like being able to see both my close friends and like Instagram people who I follow and admire and like hot models on public and seeing how they specifically invest in why, who I can relate to. It's very, very cool. I want to say, I think Cash App allows you to invest now too. Like a lot of these apps are starting to open up into micro investing is the sort of techie phrase. Micro investing is just being able to invest $5 or $10 and let people sort of dabble. But again, Auntie Berna is telling you only invest money that you are willing to lose because I don't want you out here crying on TikTok about how you lost your entire child's like college savings off of GameStop. We're not doing that.
That's great. That's great. Yes. Very good advice. I would definitely endorse that as well. Yes. Berna, I heard you mention a little earlier about crypto. Oh. I know that, yeah, I've been, you know, kind of hearing crypto. I think all of us have been hearing crypto everywhere. It is all the hotness right now. Yes. But it can also be really, really confusing. And like you said, oftentimes that the people that talk about it or the way it's talked about might just, it's half the time it sounds like gibberish.
Oh my God.
but you did just release a couple of episodes on your podcast, Money Please, about cryptocurrency. Just as a quick, I know you can't, you know, tell us everything and teach us everything in this short amount of time, but maybe what are like 1 to 3 things that you learned that you'd like to share with us about crypto?
I would love to share, especially because, and it's learning is the operative word here, because crypto and NFTs, that's where I'm like, ooh, I cannot be giving you advice. I'm a learner in that situation because it's so new. And like I said, I'm very risk averse. I don't get like all hopped up and like hot and bothered wanting to put my money into new things. I'm very like, I like my cash. And so for Money Please, our podcast, we interviewed Carmen Perez of Make Real Sense. To me, Carmen Perez is like, she is my crypto safe space. I watch her learn about crypto, and I've watched her learn about crypto for the last couple of years, and she's so open about what she's learning about on Twitter and on Instagram. Like, we talked about in the podcast how she was sort of caught up in like a Bitcoin scam and like got into a crypto scam because she like bought at the wrong time off of bad advice. And investing in Bitcoin is like investing in anything else. Investing in crypto is like investing in anything else, and that we cannot predict what's going to happen to it. And so for me, I'm still very sort of like arm's length away from crypto, but understanding that like this shit's not going anywhere. We're going to have to understand it eventually. So what I learned from that conversation with Carmen, one is like, if you want to feel like we are living in a real life sci-fi movie, go ahead and look into the background of crypto. That shit's crazy. It's literally like, I once had a conversation with somebody who worked at Gemini, which is like a cryptocurrency custodian, they call it, it's just a cryptocurrency like platform. And I had them explain to me where the hell cryptocurrency even comes from. Like, what is this? How do we get here? It sounds like a legitimate sci-fi movie. It's like a one man once upon a time, like hit a bunch of like pieces of things that have value, like in computers, like in a network, and people are mining to get it. And because it's hard to get it, it creates the value. It's very much this like kind of strange hyped up system where we've like put value onto a type of digital currency. And just like dollar bills and monetary currency, it only matters because we say it matters. You know, like it's one of those things where it's like if everyone in the world were like, fuck dollars, our currency is high fives. What's the federal government going to do about it? Like it only has value because we put value to it, right? Same with cryptocurrency. It's like it's digital currency and it has value because a bunch of people hyped it up and said it has value, much like so many other different kinds of investments. So anyway, that's one thing I learned. It's just like the background of cryptocurrency made me disassociate for real. Like I sort of had like a mental health, like, oh my God, what the fuck planet are we on? That might make you not excited about cryptocurrency or make you really excited. The second thing I learned is that the sort of one of the bases of cryptocurrency, why it was made, is this whole concept of decentralization. I think they call it like descent or something in the crypto world. That's how you know a world is getting crazy, when people are starting to acronym things that you don't even understand in the first place. But the whole concept is decentralization, which basically means like the way our financial system works now is if I wanted money, if I wanted dollars, I typically have to go to a bank. And I have to like open an account with them. To open an account, I need to have like US citizenship. If I'm in a different country, I might need to be a man in order to open up an account. I might need to be in a city where there are even banks. Like there are all these barriers. I need to have the right paperwork. I need to be a specific kind of person. There are all these barriers and gatekeepers actually to be able to like access and manage money. The idea with cryptocurrency is that like nobody owns this currency. There's no federal government telling us today the value of the dollar is so and so and so and we're making this many dollars. Like cryptocurrency, the idea is it's sort of like owned by no one and it's accessible by anybody with the internet. Like you could, if you have Wi-Fi access, you can sign up for like a cryptocurrency account and start buying and selling and keeping cryptocurrency without having to have a certain citizenship status, without having to like adhere to the money rules of your country or of your city or of your state. And it's supposed to be breaking down a lot of barriers in terms of access to money. So that's kind of cool. The third thing, though, that I think is really important to point out when we talk about cryptocurrency is there are a lot of not great implications right now of cryptocurrency. For example, all this like mining I just told you about, which is basically like there are big giant supercomputers in the world that are out looking for cryptocurrency to like sell to sci-fi movie fucked up. Giant supercomputers working to create cryptocurrency for us to use are apparently extremely damaging to the environment. I just learned this recently too, that it's like many, many times more damaging to be running these supercomputers and like running these mining programs than so many other industries that we point to as damaging, like the oil industry and the energy industry. And so it's, again, all that to say, cryptocurrency is very early days. It's something to keep track of. It's something you can start playing with inside of an app like Acorns or Public or Cash App. You can buy like certain kinds of cryptocurrency and hold it and see what happens, just like an investment. But I would say it's not something that, please God, don't cash out your 401ks or anything to get into cryptocurrency. I'm like trying to stay away from the fever of it all right now and kind of holding and waiting to see what happens.
That was a beautiful
breakdown.
It was a really great breakdown. I feel like I've kind of dived into like a 2-hour long podcast as my intro, and I was like, what? My mind was like gonna explode. But I loved you hit on some of the big points, which is just, I like that you emphasize that your perspective now is to be a learner, because everyone is learning, and to it helps everyone to not feel stupid in thinking that it's really confusing, because it is. I think it's confusing to everyone. I like how you also specified that it is something that probably at some point we will need to be well-versed in. Yeah. It's not going to be tomorrow, so no one needs to freak out, but it is something too good to start to just like get a general understanding of. Mm-hmm. I feel like we walked through so many different topics in investing. I've learned so much, and I hope our listeners have as well. But Berna, to wrap us up, we are wondering, as someone who is a personal financial specialist like yourself, what are some of your own personal finance resources? I know you've shared a couple throughout our episode, but any ones that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yes, of course. First of all, I wish I could just like reach through people's headphones, not to be creepy, but just like massage your brain, because we did cover so much. And I want to tell you that like if you only took away one little tidbit of anything I said, and like, don't worry about the rest. Start somewhere and just pick out one. This was a masterclass right here. This was like a crash course in all the things, which is so awesome. And you can and should repeat this episode over and over to like try to get the gems. But absolutely go slow in whatever you're trying to pursue from here. Go slow. Money is not going anywhere, as much as cryptocurrency bros want to keep screaming at us. The dollar bill is not going anywhere anytime soon in our lifetimes. We still have time to manage what the hell's going on here before we all live in Mark Zuckerberg's back pocket or whatever. Yeah. Oh, the metaverse. Don't even. But I would say right now, my favorite personal financial resources, I always have to shout out, and I already did, Tiffany Alice, the Budgetnista, is the first person to ever make me feel seen in the personal financial industry. I was inhaling a lot of books and podcasts and blogs from older white dudes. And Tiffany Alice is a woman. She is a Black woman. She is a hilarious educator. She's a former preschool teacher, which, again, I mentioned before, I'm basically a child. And she has this this way of teaching like basic financial concepts where I just feel like I'm talking to my best friend who's also like a preschool teacher and can break things down for me. She's incredible. She's always who I turn to first when I don't understand something. I'm like, explain it to me like I'm five, Tiffany. I am five. She's absolutely incredible. I also would point to one of my favorite YouTubers, financial YouTubers of all time. Her name is Yanely Espinal, aka Miss Be Helpful, on YouTube and on Instagram. Yanely is that, like, just, she's the friend who's going to break it down for you in very real terms. And, like, again, she's another person where when I listen to her, I feel like I'm just sort of talking to my best friend. She's also the kind of person that'll sort of like slap you upside the head with reality of being first gen and the struggles that we all go through. She is a Latina from the Bronx. I want to say she has something like 11 brothers and sisters. And so she has such an incredible perspective on intergenerational wealth. She also works for a company called Next Gen Personal Finance, and she helps teachers teach personal education, personal finance education better. So she's just like my educational go-to. And then my favorite financial podcast is Brown Ambition. And it speaks to all people of color, especially women of color. It's actually, oh my God, I'm just like the biggest Tiffany Alice fangirl. It's Tiffany Alice, but also another financial educator, Mandy Woodruff. And listening to them, that was also the first time I was like, oh, these are two besties talking about money. They break down both like financial current events and like real actual financial like listener questions in a way that feels super, super, super accessible. So I love Brown Ambition. Another podcast I really love, you know, besides the Money Please podcast, which I host with Betches, okay, plug. But one podcast I was just telling a friend about that's been around since 2016, it's called Bad With Money by Gabby Dunn. And Gabby Dunn, the whole podcast is incredible, but Gabby, they do such an incredible job at diving into the identity behind finance. Like, they did an episode on like, how does queerness affect our finances? What is reparations for the Black community? And what would that mean for all of us today? How do addictions like affect our finances? How do eating disorders affect our finances? Like, Gabby does such an incredible job of bringing in experts, and they dig so deep into the identity politics of money. And it brings money into your whole world in such a fascinating way. And can't say enough good things about Gabby and what they do.
Wow. I am so happy you shared all these resources with us and our listeners. Yes. I have a 5-hour drive for the holidays coming up. And,
oh, yes.
Or have I five? Yeah. And so I'm going to be using all of this to learn.
Yeah. Are you coming back up to the Bay?
I am. I just realized the episode is coming out later, but I have a long drive, and these resources will be great.
Yes, yeah, right. With Gabby Dunn, their podcast has been around since 2016, so you've got lots to dig into.
Awesome.
And so many other things.
I'm excited. Thank you so much for sharing all these incredible podcasts. And to wrap us up with our last question, Berna, for anyone who wants to learn more, where can they find you?
Oh, boy. Well, proceed at your own risk. The ratchetry that you've heard today very much continues on my Instagram. My Instagram is Hey Berna. So that's HEYBERNA, not Burma, like the former kingdom, not Brenda. That's literally not my name. Someone called me that at a bar on Saturday and I ripped into them. It's Hey BERNA on Instagram. I'm also on TikTok, but really I, again, as like a millennial, I'm sort of like, I don't know what I'm doing here. So Instagram is the place to find me for sure.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you both so much for having me. This has been incredible and lovely and cozy, and I'm happy to always share more.
If you don't already, please follow us on Spotify, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and review, and share this episode with your friends. You can also support us through monthly donations at anchor.fm/AsianBossGirl/support or get some merch at AsianBossGirl.myshopify.com.
If you resonated with today's episode, let us know in the comments of our IG post. And if you'd like to put faces to our names, you can find us on YouTube, where we share vlogs, an audience Q&A segment called Dear ABG, and much more. Our handle on both platforms is at Asian Boss Girl.
We do have a couple shout-outs for this episode. To Joy from Wilson, happy birthday, Joy. I am so happy we found each other. I love you. That is so sweet. To Soohyun from Manuel, happy birthday, Soohyun. You're my one and only Asian boss girl. I've been so lucky to have you be part of my life these past couple of years. Thank you for sharing the ABG podcast with me. Melody, Helen, and Jan have always done an awesome job at bringing people onto the show. They're doing amazing things, and it's very inspiring to see. That is so kind, Manuel. And to my dabs, Van Van, Lisa, Michelle, Diana, Helen, and Mish from Vivian Lee, I'm so glad we were finally able to meet and feel refreshed from our girls' trip. I'm so inspired by each of you boss ladies. Keep slaying. Love you.
If you'd like to send a shout out to a friend, check out our link tree in our link in bio on our Instagram and click on shout outs. And last but not least, thank you to our super talented editor, Michelle, for working all her magic on our episodes, including this one.
We'll catch you all in the next episode.
Bye. Bye.